Welcome to episode 120 of the Bulak podcast. I'm Ursula Lindsay in Brussels, and I'm here with my friend and co-host, Marsha Links Quayle from Rabat.
Hello.
Hi, Marsha. And today we're going to be talking about some books that we have recently reviewed, published, read, heard about in the last month. I think the last episode that we're going to have before a bit of a summer hiatus. So we're going to catch up on some interesting things that we've been doing or hearing about, and some things to look out for, some books that we recommend. So where should we start? I mean, I had the good luck to go to a literary conference in Marseille a couple weeks ago and pick up some books there, speak to a few people who we've had on the podcast, whose work we've discussed on the podcast before, which was really, really lovely. I saw the Moroccan author Karima Ahdad, who has a new book of short stories out in Arabic. I saw Samer Yazbek speak about her book, the Syrian journalist and novelist. We've definitely talked about one of her novels in the past on the podcast.
Yeah, it's such an incredible project. We have on Arablit an interview with Samer, an interview with Larry, the translator, as well as a review of that book. And I think one of the interesting things about how it was, just to mention how it was translated, was because it was such a traumatizing experience of writing it. So go ahead and explain what this book is.
Well, it's a collection of interviews with people who had been evacuated from Gaza, I believe, in the first year of the war in Gaza, and they had been in Qatar. And so she conducted many, many interviews with, and I believe almost everyone she spoke to had been evacuated also because they had sustained very serious injuries. So they were medical evacuees. Yeah.
It was not a book she intended to write. I think she was on her way elsewhere at the time, but she, I believe her daughter was in the hospital there, and she came across, amputees, people whose lives had been swiftly and severely changed by the genocide, and that she began gathering their stories. And
it's titled in English, "Your Presence is a Danger to Your Life, Voices from Gaza."
Yeah. And it's out from Fitzcarraldo. A tremendously difficult experience to write. I know from Larry, it was a traumatizing to translate.
Larry Price, who was Larry the translator. Price. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that the way Yasmina, Samer's agent, organized it was that all the translators who were working into different languages kind of put their questions together in one shared Google document, so that Samer didn't have to sort of go back and back and back and kind of re-traumatize herself over and over again. I mean, I think, you know, in a certain sense, I know Larry felt kind of self-conscious talking about how traumatizing, you know, it's like sort of third degree trauma at this point, right? That happened to people, which is obviously the real traumatizing event. And then some are putting together this book, and then the translators, but she does talk about how, what it kind of a bizarre, nightmarish experience it is, right? Like, because you get up and the sun is out and you're fine, and then you re-engage with these incredibly painful stories.
I mean, I think it's similar to at one point we had read and discussed a book of testimony from Yemen.
Yes, which is also from and Savad, actually. Larry said she spoke to Savad during the process, because I think Savad is sort of, in at least with Arabic to English translation, kind of the pioneer of talking about the traumatizing aspects and what to kind of do and how to maneuver through this process. So yeah.
I mean, I have to say, it is a book so Summer read, she had difficulty even reading it. And it's a book that both to write and to read is very difficult when I'm not sure that I would feel up to reading it in full right now or recommending it to someone to read right now, because it's asking a lot of people. But of course, you know, the work that she does, and Samar has also written all these books on Syria, from Syria, like she alternates between fiction and these projects that are a reportage and witnessing. And it's this very, very important, witnessing really that she's doing, and the creation of this record is really important. I think it's very painful. It was painful even to be exposed to, just in the space of this of the festival. Although I thought that and this was this festival put on by a organization called Karkade that does cultural events linked to Arabic literature in Marseille. But it was not, I mean, there was elements of it that were very, very sad, and they were all pretty much directly linked to Gaza. Like there was also the Palestinian poet Yusuf al-Khidr read a couple poems that like were absolutely devastating, but also some of the most beautiful poems I've heard in a long time, and that have really stayed with me. So there was also something, it was, a pretty intimate setting, like not a big event in terms of like not a huge audience, like a nice smaller spaces, and it felt very convivial and very like there was a space to both be sad but then also to be happy, to be together, to speak very in a very relaxed and sort of honest way, to have Arab writers from all over, from Berlin, from Istanbul, from all these different parts of Europe and the region, in this Mediterranean city, to feel like Arabic literature was sort of being situated inside the Mediterranean. It was really, I was really, really happy to be able to be there. And it was
Can you tell us about some of the other books that you picked up?
I picked up Karima Ahdad's book, although I have not started reading it yet because I'm, lazy about reading in Arabic now because I've gotten out of the habit. But it is a short story collection and I'm very excited to read it. And I was also really enjoyed meeting her in person and hearing more from her about what she's up to. So that's on my list. And then I picked up a book by a writer who is Suhail Ayoub, who is Lebanese from the city of Tripoli. Mm-hmm. And this book has been translated into French. I think it's Sinbad, maybe? I have it here on my shelf. And it's called The Wolf of the Family, Le Loup de la Famille. And that one I've started, and it's very interesting. It has a very strong original kind of language, like it's all like a sort of, I don't know if you'd call it surreal. The language is, it's also told from the point of view of like a child or a young person. It's kind of got this I don't know, every paragraph is almost like a prose poem. There's a lot there. It's not no sentence I would say takes like the expected path. There's a lot of surprises.
Interesting.
I think it's also very well translated into French. Like the translation itself seems very accomplished, because it seems like a text that could not have been easy. And then I didn't get a copy of it, but I very much want to read Lamia Ziadeh's new book. So she's this Lebanese, Franco-Lebanese writer and artist, and does these beautiful big books that combine drawings in this sort of style that she's developed with texts. They're not exactly graphic novels because they don't have panels, but I guess that's sort of a way you could describe it. And you know, I love the art. It's kind of inspired a bit by like, you know, movie posters, like the hand-drawn, hand-painted movie posters, or like kind of old, cheap, pulpy novels and publications like you could find in like the Arab world. Like it's got this sort of very bright, slightly simplified style, but it's painterly. They're very pretty. And this book is, from what I gathered from her talk, is a sort of memoir partly about her youth and moving to France and studying art in Paris during the Lebanese Civil War, kind of, you know, escaping into this space of like personal freedom and the arts. And it was very exciting, and she had very, you know, successful, glamorous, you know, discovery of Paris as a young person and a young artist, and then the sort of gradual reemergence or emergence of kind of like political concerns that she had almost kind of like stamped down or avoided in the beginning of her, you know, I mean, she talked, you know, in sort of integrating into France as a young person and an Arab person, and, you know, at a time when people would tell her, well, you're not really an Arab. Like, right. Because you're Lebanese, because you're Christian, because you're, you know, because you're cool, because you're like going out and drinking and wearing, you know, like you're not what they, because they meant something else by the term Arab in France then. And then I think the story is also, again, a story that ends up back at Palestine and Gaza partly. And that's what was repressed from her, from her work, from her conversation, from her mind, I think for many years, and then kind of, you know, her re-engagement with a lot of that. And so it's the story of partly like becoming politicized or re-politicized, and this, a story of immigration. I really look forward to reading it.
That's great. Yes, I me too. I read Olivia Snege's review of it, and I can't wait to get a copy myself.
Yeah, one of the other things that was fun was that Olivia was there and we got to hang out, and that was nice to have her as a companion through this, and she moderated several of the panels.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So is this going to be an annual event now, or it was?
I don't think it is necessarily an annual event. I think it was, but actually they may do another edition. I really thought that like the setting of Marseille made a lot of sense for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, like let's have events in Marseille. It's like the best city ever. Let's go there all the time. And, you know, it is a city where you feel actually connected to the other side of the Mediterranean, like very strongly, and that has like a very strong, like a North African component in it in terms of like its population and its history and everything. And it made a lot of sense to have. And there was a sort of gathering of Arabic writers from across Europe and a sort of discussion about Arabic letters in Europe today, you know, because it is spread across Europe as well.
Mm.
Yeah. Next time, hopefully you can come too.
Yes, I would love to. I would love to.
And what have you been? So I want to ask you about a project that you've been working on that came to completion recently.
Not to completion, but go ahead.
Okay. All right. Almost to completion, which is you have overseen a translation of May Ziadeh's, is it a out and out memoir? I mean, it's called Musings of a Young Woman, right?
Musings of a Young Woman is a very cross-genre, multi-genre book. So it includes it's different texts that were written between 1911 and 1921 when she was very young, but it's like, there's essays, there's poetry, there's reflections, there's a micro play. I mean, I think that there's, an element of not self-mockery, but sort of a wink in this kind of musings of a young woman. She's suggesting that it's just light literature by women, but it really is a kind of a mission statement, sort of a a statement, we are young women who write. So it's a kind of a feminist statement on this is the kind of broadness of her thought and her intellectual engagement, her creative engagement, her writing.
Sorry, for those who don't know much about her, can you just tell us what year this yes. would have been and just, you know.
Right. Right. So she was born in 1886 and died in 1941. So she was born in Nazareth. Her father was Lebanese and her mother was Palestinian. And then she moved to Cairo quite young and sort of developed intellectually there. So she kind of, you know, was in this generation where moving between these spaces was kind of, I don't know, expected. She also moved between languages. Her first collection, Fleur des Rêves, was in French. And then she shifted to Arabic, but she also read in German, Italian, Spanish, English. But she definitely chose Arabic as her sort of her, I don't know, literary home, as her sort of main language of expression. She wrote for journals like Al Halal. She hosted this very well-known literary salon, which I think is one of the things she's most remembered for, in addition to sort of the, you know, the letters she exchanged with Khalil Gibran. And I guess she's most remembered for her association with men. So part of the, although she did like intellectual histories of other women, she was sort of, you know, as I personally, there were, I don't know, maybe 25 of us, all women, engaged in this project in some way. For me, the impetus was I knew Mai Zieda as a kind of an icon, an iconic figure. I knew her photograph. I knew about her. You know, this story of her being in guardianship, committed against her will, you know, was she
by her family at what point?
Yes,
she was famously committed to an institution by a family that was sort of trying to disinherit her and control her, and she eventually escaped this. But yes, that's what I knew about her too.
Right, and so actually, as we were talking through, it was a big discussion of how we want to the bio that we want to have on the back jacket. You know, do we mention that? Is that and how do we mention it? Is that an important? You know, it is an important part of what happened to her, but also knowing her as this kind of iconic figure, and as somebody who's just kind of like represented, but without listening to her, right? Her work, it still circulates in Arabic, definitely. There has been no translation until now of her work into English or into, as far as I know, other languages, other than letters exchanged with Khalil Gibran. So she sort of exists, but also she was very marginalized in addition in Arabic, you know, right after her. She was important during her life. She contributed, I think, it would be, you know, the people around her would have certainly mentioned her as an important intellectual figure. But then she was sort of marginalized very soon after. I think as, you know, that a sort of a minor figure, a side figure, and of some kind of ridicule or pity. And so I felt like it was sort of a responsibility. I felt a responsibility to engage with her writing as her writing, right? If we know her, she's sometimes used as a kind of a feminist icon, a photo, her name circulated, but without actually engaging with her thoughts and ideas, which I think I was really surprised at, you know, how relevant to the present I found these essays, stories, articles written between 1911 and 1921, how relevant to the current moment I found them to be. And then I just, you know, would like to, so her, she died in 1941. Her last public lecture was at the American University in Cairo in January of 1941. And it was titled Live Dangerously. And I mean, I just think that, you know, these figures from the past can sometimes be kind of leached of not just like the nuance and interest, but like the prickly elements and the power of their thought. And Rose Damaris also is at work translating these first poems from her very first collections, Fleurs de Rêve, which I must have come out around 1911. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but it was her very first collection, her only one written in French. And I also find these poems written by this very young, but extraordinarily broad-minded, interesting, and really engaged with a sort of, I don't know, same anti-colonial global thought that is engaging us now. And you know, what is, you know, how does she situate herself as a woman? And I was really blown away by the poetry, by her writing. And then, you know, sometimes to the extent where I feel a little bitter, like, oh, everybody knows Khalil Gibran, but this is better.
Yeah.
We're currently, it's all complete, right? We've made the translations, edited them, proofread them. We're serializing it currently, and you can sign up to an email newsletter. And then once we finish, because in sort of the old Hassan Abdel Qudus, although we're doing the cheat version, not where we like, you know, like Hassan did, sit down on a Friday, write a new chapter of his novel and publish it the next week. We're doing it the cheat Naguib Mahfouz way, which is do the whole thing first, be entirely ready with it, and then let it be published week by week. And then once come October, that's when the paperback full version of the book will be released.
So if people want to sign up for the serialized version, where do they go?
They can either go to ArabLit/MyZieda, or just if they go to the front page of ArabLit, they'll find it.
Okay.
Yeah. And we also have on our YouTube channel we had a wonderful launch event with several of the translators and editors talking about, and also Rose was there reading some of her translations of Mai's poetry.
This is a question I have. I think you said 25 people were involved in this project. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what is it? Different? Did different translators translated different essays and poems in the series?
Yes. I mean, so there are a number of people who are, of course, long and deeply engaged with Maizieda's work. Marilyn Booth, for instance, I think this was maybe even before her PhD. So, you know, Marilyn Booth has been working with translating Maizieda for, well, I don't know. I don't want to overestimate or underestimate, but let's say many decades. And so we revisited her translations. And there's other people working with Mai's work as scholars who have worked on translations, and we want to kind of, so some people, but we wanted a kind of a large group, actually, a salon, as it were, of women translators, editors, proofreaders, to be part of this project, sort of being a large group project was, I don't know. I think was part of the process, was part of our way of honoring Mai and her work. So yes, people chose different. Some people only did one. Some people did more than one. And then there was, of course, a process, you know, an editor-translator pairing process for reviewing the work, and then for kind of trying to, you know, making the style very similar across while not kind of erasing the translatedness of the work.
Well, I look forward to reading this. I think that the reference that I most remember about her, I'm pretty sure in Imen Marcel's In Search of an Ayet El Zayet book, there is a passage in which she discusses women cutting their hair. And it is this almost like this beautiful standalone, you know, couple pages where she talks about various women writers and the moment at which they cut their hair. And often these are moments of like grief or reckoning of some kind.
Well, for Anayet, it was a moment before her suicide, was it not?
Right. Well, as Marcel imagines it, there's also a bit of her. But, and I believe that Maisieta is in that list of the women that she discusses, you know, who are often facing a sort of conflict or a crisis or a loss of some kind in their life. I would have to go back and find it, but...
I actually grabbed it from the shelf behind me and I'm currently flipping through the pages in desperate search of it.
Do you have a PDF version? Because that would be easier to find that way.
No, I've got a paper. Oh my God. On page 185, I just did come across the name Maisiet. So I think, I'm going to send an email to Imen Marcel right after this too, because I would love to know more about her research into an engagement in Maisieta. And this is going to lead, I think we've decided for sure that we are going to do this kind of, well, Samira Azem was the first book in this series. This will be the second book in the series. And the idea is to do an erased, not forgotten series where we re-engage as Imen did with Maisieta. Probably mostly women. It's not a commitment to only women, but re-engage writers who were marginalized from the literary canon or corpus in some way, who we think we would like to reconnect with their work.
I think that's a great idea.
As we're talking about, it's currently a moment of hot contestation. Who will be the next writer in the series.
Well, one thing is you could pick the next, you know, you can make a long list and then, you know, yes, you can have one, but you can have behind that many other potential ones too.
Yeah, definitely. There are a lot of, they're all women at this point that we're looking at, but who were, you know, really kind of vibrant and really a part of. They're all kind of, I don't know, modern classics, you know, or generally speaking, early 20th century writers who were really a vibrant part of the literary landscape in Algeria or Syria or wherever it is. And, but somehow kind of, you know, edged out of the canon as it became, you know, more solidified, more nationalist often, I think, which is one of the things that happened to Maisieta is not, you know, of course, there's gender as a part of it, but also, where does she belong? You know, is she a Lebanese writer? Is she a Palestinian writer? Does she belong in the Egyptian tradition and canon? Because she moved between these spaces.
Yeah, no, I can totally see that. And you're going to continue to do this in collab, like as a collective, like people who are involved in this first project, some of them are continuing to like move forward as a group to pick the next book and translate it.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, of course, people are championing their own their own projects. Yes, I would love if this group, which does not have, I think, you know, it was by chance that that it became an all women collective, but it doesn't need to remain that way. Translation happens to be a highly women dominated space, and although we did are paying the translators of this collection. It's not like, you know, so high paying that people need to beat down my door to be a part of it. So, I hope all of us continue to stay a part of the next project in some capacity or another.
Well, cool. So yeah, I'm going to go, I love the idea of getting a book in like sections like that over the summer. That sounds really nice. And everybody should visit the site and sign up also to get the hard copy at the end of it, which will be like you said, the first English translation of her work ever, and like a really like unique publication.
Yeah, and we will be doing more launch events in October.
Cool. For people well, congrats. Who want to
participate and ask their own questions and demand answers of us.
Demand your next translation. Watch out.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, then back to you. Tell us about what you've been working on and reviewing lately.
Well, I've been reading a bunch of Rabih Alameddin. I have a review coming out at some point of multiple of his books for the New York Review of Books, and so actually I had the great pleasure. I mean, I'd read The Wrong End of the Telescope, which is a novel that he published that addresses the sort of the Syrian refugee crisis in Greece. I mean, the characters go to Greece and are interacting with each other and other volunteers and refugees in the camps that were set up in Greece at the height of the Syrian refugee crisis, when hundreds of thousands of people were moving through Greece on the move towards Europe. From Syria and elsewhere. And I read that book in my book club in Amman, and we all loved it. Mm-hmm. Everybody was, he has this great approach to it. It's very kind of like kaleidoscopic, like mosaic. It's like very, very short chapters. And at first it's kind of, sort of feels kind of, it's kind of hopping and skipping from one thing to the next. And then it kind of all slowly comes together into like a full, very harmonious, actually, whole by the end of the book. Mm-hmm. It's narrated by a trans woman, and he does a very interesting thing where he sort of, without being too heavy-handed about it or spelling it out, but sort of like makes a book of reflection on like changing yourself, changing your life, moving, you know, into sort of new territory, adopting a new identity by choice or not, like that there's something kind of so universal about the refugee experience. If there's something universal about it, it's that, you know, we are all forced sometimes to like leave our old selves behind and remake ourselves completely. And again, with some part of that being a choice and some part of that not being by choice at all. Mm-hmm. And losing things along the way. Anyway, I thought that book was, and he has this playfulness. So Rabih Alameddin is a Lebanese writer. For those who don't know him, he was born in 1959 in Amman, actually grew up between Lebanon and Kuwait, emigrated young, first to the UK and then to California, has been in California for many, many years. Is gay, published his first novel, I think when he was about 40, and was a painter also, and has slowly, I think he is one of the most exciting, interesting writers, out there, and the recognition he's received now, he's won the Pen Faulkner Award, the National Book Award, like he's really, and the last three or four books, so he wrote The Wrong End of the Telescope. The book before that is, I think, An Unnecessary Woman. And the book before that is The Angel of History. And I love all three of these books very much. I think they're
love The Angel of History.
Right. So The Angel of History is the book where he talks about being, his main character is a Yemeni poet who also moved to California and is a survivor of the AIDS epidemic. And it is, a reflection. There's a kind of, in the story, Yemen is being bombed. It's the 90s. This character is also thinking back on all the lovers and friends he died. He lost to AIDS, decades earlier. It's so lyrically written. That one, I agree, really like, I mean, the main character is a poet. The language has to live up to that. He's also being like haunted by like Satan and angels.
Yeah, it also manages to be funny and to have these very tightly interwoven stories within stories. I really enjoyed that one.
I mean, he's always funny. That's the thing. So that's one of the things that you have to say about him is that there's always a lot of humor in the stories and a humor that is campy sometimes, that is catty sometimes, that, you know, there's a lot of like asides and quips. He makes Satan in that book like deliver all these like great, you know, catty speeches and stuff. I mean, it's
In this one in particular, I felt in this his latest book, Raja the Gullible, I felt it was a little bit like, you know, a kind of a one man burlesque show at some points. Yeah, he has that kind of really enjoyable voice that he can access.
Yeah, so the latest book is this book called The True Story of Raja the Gullible (parentheses) and His Mother. And this is the one that just won the National Book Award. Just before we get to this, yes, it is narrated by a gay man who enjoys cross dressing. There is a gay story at the center of it, love story, hate story. And just before we get there, I mean, just to sort of give it a little bit more sense of the breadth of the topics that he does. So we talked about there's the Angel of History, An Unnecessary Woman, which is also a fantastic book, is entirely narrated from an elderly female translator who lives in Beirut and is like aging alone there and has, you know, spends all her time translating books and then packing them away in boxes in her second bathroom in her apartment in Beirut. She never publishes anything, but she's this incredibly like erudite voice. He gets to put all his literary opinions and great citations. And it's just this little sad, like, because it's also a sad story. She's lonely. She's aging. She's vulnerable. And yet she has this great wealths of sort of intellectual richness and pride, you know, that nobody suspects. I mean, he's also very, all of his books, I think, have very strong voices. Like, they're usually often the first person, and there's usually very strong personalities in them.
Mm. And I think we often come back to the Lebanese Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's maintained a very strong relationship to Lebanon. He goes back and forth often. The Middle East in one way or another figures, you know, the characters always have a connection to that part of the world. So this latest book is actually entirely set in Beirut again.
Well, there's the trip to the U.S.,
there's a brief trip. And so the latest book is the main character is this philosophy professor in Beirut, teaches philosophy at the high school, at the French high school. He's in his 50s. And then the other main character, as the title hints, is his mother, who he lives with. I mean, I would say, you know, it's a father-mother love story. Like, they are the romantic couple of the book.
Yes, the mother-son, yes.
Yeah.
And they have a wonderful relationship. Fun, funny, striking.
So I'm going to be honest and tell you, I enjoyed this book as much, I mean, very much, but I enjoyed it less than some of the previous ones. I found it less lyrically written, less I think because it sticks more to things that have happened recently, like it covers basically COVID and the port explosion in Beirut. And then it goes back and covers the Civil War, the banking crisis. It seemed to me like a little bit angrier and blunter book than the previous ones. And
okay, so I'm going to say
less imaginative, like less.
Right. Okay. For me, on the level of language, there are other books of his that I think are much more interesting and beautifully crafted and created, like Angels of History. I think it's masterfully done. On the level of the sort of intimate relationships portrayed and emotional content of this book, I felt swept away. The relationship between him and his mother, between him and his, you know, Faru in particular, between him and Budi, I don't know. I felt at no, and him and his students, I felt at no point could I look away. And the anger, I found that raw anger of it to be very compelling. I felt at no moment could I look away from what was happening in this book.
And I mean, I didn't want to look away either. I wanted to see what happened next. I guess the voice of the narrator to me was less, maybe because it is so angry that it almost renders him inarticulate at times, like compared to the narrator of An Unnecessary Woman or of The Angel of History, even the actual terms that he uses, you know, like calls people stupid and brats and shit.
Yeah, well, it really felt to me more like a stage performance, like we were watching him tell us this novel as it unfolds on stage, in a raw way, in a less literally crafted way than his other books. But I enjoyed that experience.
Do you want to read a passage from it?
I would love to. How about the port explosion? Because he does, you know, come back to the financial crisis and how incredibly angry his mother is, and he is as well. And then also, yeah, the port explosion is also a moment of very raw emotion.
Right. And for anybody who doesn't know at this point, which I think most people do, or, you know, so I can't remember now how many years ago this was already, when the port explosion happened, 21, there were these massive containers of fertilizer at the Beirut port, and they were poorly and unsafely stored next to like a warehouse of fireworks. And this incredibly devastating explosion took place that like leveled a huge part of the center of the city. And, you know, it was a result of such negligence and corruption and, you know, and coming on top of so many other things that the country had suffered, just seemed like the, you know, encapsulation of all this like harm that's been done to the city. And so he writes about the aftermath of this.
I had never been in a nuclear explosion. The destruction of the neighborhood next to the port, the one not protected from the blast by the concrete grain silos, might not have been as terrible as the flattening of Hiroshima, which I'd seen in photos. But then I hadn't stood in the midst of the Japanese city the day after the bomb was dropped. I had stupidly thought I would come down and help clean up whatever I could, but I could barely move a muscle. Like a sudden rainstorm appearing out of nowhere, veils of sorrow overwhelmed my heart. I had lived through a civil war. I had crossed the infamous green line several times, but nothing had prepared me for what I saw. As if the war years, the numerous Israeli bombings, the Syrian destruction, the car bombs, were lease installments to the lords of grief. But now the balloon payment was due. My legs trembled. I felt dizzy. I ended up sitting on the hood of a crushed silver Mercedes, of all things, as if it were a Hidean throne, my brush broom, a scepter. I was 20 years old in 1980 when the Panamanian boxer cried, "No mas," and the fans and media were so offended at his quitting the fight. I knew nothing about boxing then or now, but I remembered thinking at the time that if someone was raining blows on me, I too would want the world to stop rotating and give me some time to catch my breath. 40 years later, On the hood of a Mercedes weighed down by a chunk of concrete on its roof, I was whispering, "No mas, no mas, no mas." The sullen buildings of the neighborhood, forcibly divested of glass and slabs and facades, felt as if they were taking their last breaths, as if they were trees after a forest fire had passed through. The blast had happened the day before, yet dust danced everywhere, refusing to settle. The structures continued to crumble. An aluminum frame fell from some floor up above, after which a half-burnt curtain floated down, landing not more than 2 meters away from my throne. Shards and scraps and blood covered everything. My gaze relinquished one atrocity for another, one horror for another, and people like me who came to see, standing in groups or not, together yet all alone. We, the shocked, the horrified, too stunned to do anything but gawk. Ours is a tale of unremitting death, violence, and destruction narrated with apathy. I was in my city, yet I wasn't. When I ascended from the garage apartment that summer in 1975, the city felt strange. What was familiar became alien, and now the alien had become, oh, so familiar. I shut my eyes. No mas. I took a slow, unfaltering breath. But how much grief could one inhale? My heart split like a melon, and I began to tear up, slowly and gently at first, and then weeping. I couldn't reopen my eyes. I no longer wanted to see what was around me, and I felt embarrassed. I didn't wish to know who was seeing me crying, and I couldn't stop. The humiliation of weeping in public was bad enough, but more, much more, I was overwhelmed with the ignominy of living Lebanese. So I think that passage does show some of this kind of the rawness of emotion that animates this book.
And still, even in this book, which I just finished saying, doesn't have the same sort of like linguistic fireworks maybe as some of the other ones. And even there, there's multiple, he has turns of phrase that are so his own and, you know, sitting on the hood of the Mercedes like a throne and the balloon payment coming due. And I mean, they're always there's a touch. And sometimes even in it, like a little bit of humor and just this originality of description. I think really he's the sort of breadth of his works and the amount of originality and verve that he has in his writing, of where he just feels like he's creating new worlds each time.
And I also love that this character is also a writer and is self-deprecating in a way that does not at all feel like false modesty from the author, but feels real and genuine and funny.
I didn't realize the philosophy professor is a writer.
Well, he's got that book about meditations of
Japanese. Oh, yeah. I mean, I found this book interesting also for how, like, it is a strange book. Like, it pulls together elements in a way where they almost don't. I mean, he always, like, pulls a lot of things together. He's a writer who does digressions, does like seemingly not connected elements, but then they always kind of usually like really click into place. Mm. He is quite a master of the sort of like seemingly very free floating kind of like storytelling that's like very fluid and like, you know, going on tangents. And then what I find, you know, really striking is how much every time it does like coalesce, how strongly it coalesces. For me, the other thing that was interesting about this book is that the real tension and unresolved tension between some of the portions of it, like where like it's not clear to me what the ultimate, like things are left really unresolved, like in terms of what they mean or what their import is or how they fit together.
Definitely. Where some things, the two characters who I think we can rely on most, you know, the narrator and his mother have different opinions about things too, give us different views on things.
Yeah, I mean, there's this great affection between, you know, the gay son and his slightly domineering mother, who he like adores for how kind of, you know, fierce she is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet there's also these accounts of her from when he was a child in which she is a completely different woman and they have a completely different relationship in which she is actually, you know, completely deferential to the husband and brother who the narrator detests. Right. So it's just like such open Oedipal, like he's like, I hate my father's so stupid. I hate him. My older brother's so stupid. I hate him. Like, I only love my mother. Like, it's just like, so, you know, and at one point, finally, they get rid of all these other guys and it's just the two of them together, like happily ever after. So who she was when he was younger is completely different from who she is now. There's this wild central relationship of the book where his like teenage romance is like, you know, in captivity practically with like a militia fighter. It's like kind of like a romantic, sexy fantasy. And then like partly like very disturbing, like he's like kidnapped by a militia fighter and then they immediately initiate a relationship. And so the civil war for him is like cross-dressing in like a hideout and like waiting for his militia boyfriend. It's just like there's wild elements. And then he, this sort of the end of the relationship is also his literal coming out. He like emerges from this like hideout and like in a dress and like walks across the city. I think he's an extraordinary writer, and he just, you know, this book was different from the previous ones, which tended to have more like a kind of overwhelming flow, like being swept along in a river, and a much more kind of like a language also that transports you and moves you along so that you don't question any part of the story. This one to me was more like every once in a while I would kind of be like very startled by something that was happening.
Yeah, well, I think that's its own accomplishment too. It gets you to look at the story itself as well. But also, I just, to me, there was not a moment when I did not want to keep reading.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's a great writer, and I think that I mean, really, the accomplishment of his last 4 or 5 books taken all together is like extraordinary.
Mm. And as you mentioned, one of the main differences of this one too is that he's dealing with a very kind of present, things that are not at all. He hasn't had a chance to work through them in any way, you know, the financial crisis or whatever the bank robbery, the massive bank heist in Lebanon, and the port explosion, in addition to all these other compounded psychological wounds.
Right. And then also it is a love letter to a mother. It is, you know, they have this sort of bickering, contentious relationship that is actually so affectionate. So, I had a lot of thoughts about it too. I mean, they depend on each other so much. And there's a line somewhere in there where she says like, oh, you should have taken me along to, you know, I think it is to see the aftermath of the explosion. And she says something like, you would have needed to make me feel better and it would have made you feel better.
And
that's kind of the relationship. But also you see how this sort of codependency or love that they have is in the context of outside having almost nobody else they can rely on. It's a kind of dire setting that they're in, and like blow after blow, and yet they have each other.
Right. I also think that he, in the sense that he opens up the world for her, right? Like her husband and many societal expectations closed down her world, but allows herself to become this larger than life figure because her son paved the way for her in some ways. So there is this kind of, there are moments where their relationship flips, you know, where either of them can be in the parenting role.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like there's something about his coming out is her coming out as well. Mm. Like, so, like it's literally he comes home and they like move into a bedroom together.
Yes. And, yes.
And it's her discarding of her. I mean, not completely. The brother remains a troubling, like,
right,
continues to indulge this, like, you know, selfish older brother for much longer. But yeah, her final transformation mirrors some like transformation in him. But it's not neat. Like, but in a way that I think is interesting. Like, he says elsewhere in other books, he talks about like not liking to give psychological explanations for everything and not wanting things to be like always have a cause or always have an explanation in the story for everything that characters do. And I think he's playing with that here too. There's scenes that just have a kind of mystery in terms of like the motivations or the relationship. And then those are actually the scenes that kind of stayed with me.
Mm. Yeah, no, I love their relationship.
I was going to suggest, I mean, like, that maybe I just take us out on one more reading from, like, another book of his. And tell everybody just go read the books. There's really nothing more one can say other than, like, full-throatedly recommend them. But I have a couple passages from The Angel of History that I love
Great.
So much. I mean, you know, there's passages, like we said, that are like funny. But I think I'm going to read one that is more sad because it's just so beautiful. So one of the things that's happening with this character is that he's being sort of visited by memories of his former lover. And so he's speaking often to Doc, to the man who he loved and nursed and lost years before. So maybe I'll read this passage addressed to his lost lover and we'll end the episode on that.
All right. Excellent.
All right. While I was alive, I loved you while you were alive, and I loved you still, but I forgot for a while. Forgive me, I couldn't obsess about you all the time. So you disappeared as if I'd bleached my memory, but you came back, you know, like a fungal infection. Remember Thrush, the white stains that attacked your innocent tongue, looked like the snowy down on old strawberries? We couldn't get rid of it, and you hated it, and I hated it, and you wanted it over. When to make you feel better, I joked that the furry fungus matched your white lab coat. You turned apoplectic, wanted to strangle me. I still regret that. I thought it was funny at the time. You've been gone for decades. You hid deep in my lakes. Why now? Why infect my dreams now? What flood is this? Once, as I was buying groceries in a store where a young third worlder mopped the floor back and forth around a yellow sign that announced piso mojado, the mephitic aroma of disinfectant assaulted my senses and you jumped the levee of my memory. Proust had his mnemonic Madeleine, but bleach was all ours, Doc, all ours. The tomatoes didn't look too good and I just went home. I'd been a coward. I was scared. Do notice I said scared and not frightened. You taught me the difference. You said children get scared. Men might feel afraid, might even feel terror, but men don't get scared. I'd been so lonely since you died. You left me roofless in a downpour. You gripped the bedrail when you took your final breath, and I had to pry open your fingers one by one to free you. It took 17 minutes because my hands were shaking so much. Even in death, you were stronger than I and more obstinate. The mortician told me it took forever to burn you. Thrice he had to put you in the incinerator. You refused to turn to ash. You sincerely believed that the distance between you and me would one day disappear. You told me I was not my mother and you were not my father, but how could we not be? How could we not be? The stones over her cenotaph still felt so very heavy. You held out your arms and said, "Join me," but I couldn't. And you said, "Let me love you," and I couldn't because you wanted to be so close. You held out the fireman's net and said, "Jump," and I couldn't. I felt the fall was much too great. I chose to go back into the fire. You said, "I like it when you doze on my chest," but I said, "The hair on your chest irritates my cheeks and makes it difficult to sleep. I could hardly bear the beauty of you." You were gone for so long, and I moved along, and everyone told me I was alive. But that night in my bed, each time my ear touched the single pillow, I heard your heartbeat once more, once more, once more, once more. My heart is restless until it rests in thee. I mean, I can't get enough of it. And he hits that gong so many times in that book. Yeah.
All right. Thanks to everybody for listening.
Yeah. Thanks. Bye-bye. Subscribe to Bulak wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bulak Books and Instagram at Bulak.books for news and updates. Please rate or review us, and if you'd like to support us, you can make a donation on our page on DonorBox. Bulak is produced in collaboration with the podcast platform SOWT, S-O-W-T, which produces many other excellent shows in Arabic on music, literature, media, and more. For all things related to Arabic literature and translation, you should visit ArabLit.org, where you can also subscribe to the ArabLit Quarterly. If you are interested in advertising on Bulak or sponsoring episodes, contact us at bulak@sout.com. All the links and addresses mentioned here are in the show notes.